From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In his first news conference since becoming president-elect, Donald Trump today blasted news outlets for reporting on unverified intelligence, and he accused U.S. intelligence agencies of leaking the unsubstantiated reports that his campaign colluded with Russia and that Russia has compromising information about him.
I think it was disgraceful that the intelligence agencies allowed any information that turned out to be so false and fake out. I think it's a disgrace. And I say that. And that's something that Nazi Germany would have done and did do.
So that was today. Last night, it was President Obama who had the stage as he gave his farewell speech, asking Americans to hold tight to values that have built the country.
That creed, reaffirmed by those who planted flags from foreign battlefields to the surface of the moon. A creed at the core of every American whose story is not yet written. Yes, we can. Yes, we did. Yes, we can.
Yes, we can. Yes, we did. Let's spend a few minutes on this moment that NPR politics editor Domenico Montanaro would characterize as... Actually, Domenico, how would you characterize this moment?
Moment in American history. It's kind of interesting for me. I was struck listening to Bob Corker, the foreign relations chairman, the Republican from Tennessee, this morning during his opening remarks with Rex Tillerson, who is Trump's Secretary of State nominee, when he said, how do we make sense for the world, for Americans? Can't you see how confusing it is for people that we went from George W. Bush to Barack Obama, and now to Donald Trump? You know, the foreign policy of the country, the domestic policy of the country, it's been so reactionary one way or the other. It's really been whiplash for the last decade or so.
Well, let's get to Trump's press conference today, which was very unusual. There was applause at times, which you don't usually see in a press conference because it's usually just reporters in the room. But in this case at Trump Tower, I guess that was not the case. But of course, the big question that a lot of reporters were asking had to do with this new report involving Trump and Russia and whether Russia had compromising information about Trump. Let's listen.
I tell this to people all the time. I was in Russia years ago with the Miss Universe contest, which did very well. Moscow, the Moscow area, did very, very well. And I told many people, be careful, because you don't want to see yourself on television. Cameras all over the place. And again, not just Russia, all over. Does anyone really believe that story? I'm also very much of a germaphobe, by the way. Believe me.
Domenico, has he put any questions to rest here with this news conference today?
Well, look, first, I think we should say about this report that none of this has been substantiated or verified. Most of it seems to have come from Oppo researchers, not saying that that information from Oppo researchers
opposition,
isn't sometimes opposition researchers within campaigns, that sometimes that information is correct. But, you know, news organizations have had some of this dossier for months and have been trying to substantiate it and have come up empty. So at this point, I think it would be irresponsible to talk about the details of it, although Trump makes it somewhat difficult when he alludes to some of the lewd details within that report, talking about how he's a germaphobe. But, you know, I think that this gives him a heat shield, because what others had reported yesterday on ties potentially to Russia and whether or not there's an FBI investigation. This now gives Trump and his team a chance to be able to whack the media and say that it's irresponsible, it's disgraceful, you shouldn't look at this discredited report, it's fake news. Whereas there are still some open questions, given we haven't seen Donald Trump's tax returns, what his financial liabilities, if any. He says there aren't, and he says that no one from his campaign had any connection with anyone in Russia before the election.
Well, look, there's also the question of how this came to the media. I mean, this was, as he said, this was leaked from somewhere. I mean, it's been around for months. There are journalists who have for weeks at least been trying to get to the bottom of this. It's been out in that way. But also it leaked out that this was what intelligence officials talked to Donald Trump about on Friday. Then it becomes news. And you have, you know, CNN reporting on it and then BuzzFeed producing some of the documents. Now, today, you mentioned the media. He did. One of his favorite targets. He savaged Donald Trump did BuzzFeed for publishing the entire 35-page dossier, which it acknowledged it couldn't verify. And he had this exchange with Jim Acosta of CNN.
Now, Mr. President-elect, since you are attacking our news organization, can you give us a chance?
Your organization
is terrible. You are attacking our news organization.
Your organization.
Can you give us a chance to ask a question, sir?
Go ahead.
Sir, can you state, Mr. President-elect, can you state categorically?
She's asking a question. Don't be rude.
Mr. President-elect, can you give us a question?
Don't be rude.
You're attacking us. Can you give us a question?
Don't be rude.
No, I'm not going to give you a question.
I'm not going to give you a question.
Can you stay categorical?
You are fake news.
Sir,
go ahead.
Can you stay categorical?
Domenico, we're going to take this up elsewhere in the program, the news angle here, the print and press angle here. But what is this? What did this whole press conference today tell you about what this administration is going to be like?
Well, certainly there's potential for it to be somewhat combative, like a moment like that. Trump tried to play somewhat of a good cop, bad cop thing early on, where you had his incoming White House press secretary, Sean Spicer, and Vice President-elect Mike Pence thwack the media somewhat to say that this was disgraceful, you shouldn't do this. And then you had Trump come out and say that actually the media has gotten a notch up from some organizations. I think he was specifically talking about the New York Times, as he alluded to later, that they didn't run with this information. He's mad at CNN. He's mad at BuzzFeed. CNN did not publish the full report in the way BuzzFeed did. CNN had different kind of reporting. And Trump, again, like I said, trying to use this heat shield. I think the bigger story is Donald Trump's relationship with the intelligence community.
Mm-hmm.
He is upset over leaks. He's furious over these leaks that are coming out. Barack Obama has been upset about any kinds of leaks. But when you continuously say that the people in the intelligence community aren't doing their jobs well and you call them intelligence in quotes, you're going to get some people within that community upset. And in the way that the Pentagon in some ways boxed in Barack Obama early on with the number of troops he could have in Afghanistan, you may be seeing some of that kind of power play happening with the intelligence community and Donald Trump.
Domenico, President-elect Trump did make a little bit of news during his news conference. He said that he has tapped David Shulkin, who is currently serving in the VA in the Obama administration, to lead the Department of Veterans Affairs. He also talked a little bit about Obamacare and said that he wanted to see a repeal and replace happen at the same time. And we know we've been talking about the fact that there are some senators, Republican senators, who agree with that sentiment. But before we let you go, we have to talk about what happened last night with President Obama, his farewell address in Chicago. Let's take a listen here. He didn't sound like a man who's leaving the stage altogether.
In 10 days, the world will witness a hallmark of our democracy. No. The peaceful transfer of power from one freely elected president to the next. I committed to President-elect Trump that my administration would ensure the smoothest possible transition, just as President Bush did for me.
What did you make of that speech last night?
You know, I thought it was a broad-ranging, big-picture speech that Barack Obama tried to put his presidency into the patchwork of the United States through its history. He also tried to bring in a sense of inclusivity to put it within an updated sort of tableau of Americana, you know, to include things like Selma and Stonewall, in addition to, Omaha Beach. He brought in Iraq and Afghanistan veterans as well. So he tried to update the picture of America, and that very much is in line with Barack Obama's idea that, you know, the moral arc of the universe bends toward justice. You know,
nope.
This is something that has been a hallmark of his presidency.
Well, but in places it was stirring. In places it was poignant for his followers, of course, his backers. But it also was perplexing for some who said, "Why didn't we hear some of this on the campaign trail from Democrats?" President Obama came back over and over again to the fact that everyone has to work to deal with the country's divisions and acknowledge the economic pain of middle-class white men. Listen.
For white Americans, it means acknowledging that the effects of slavery and Jim Crow didn't suddenly vanish in the 60s. That when minority groups voice discontent, they're not just engaging in reverse racism or practicing political correctness. When they wage peaceful protests, they're not demanding special treatment, but the equal treatment that our founders promised.
When he went on to say, I mean, what we don't have here, but what he went on to say is, and people have to recognize the white men who feel as if the rug's been pulled out from under them economically, and you know, their long-held businesses have moved on. So he was asking minorities and the black community to acknowledge that as well. And people said, why didn't we hear that?
You know, I think Barack Obama has spent a long time speaking in that way. I mean, his race speech in Philadelphia was one of the more nuanced race speeches ever given. It had been black or white previous to that. He talked about Irish, Poles, Italians, immigrant communities who don't really feel the same kind of responsibility for what's happened in minority communities over centuries. And he really tried to hit on that once again. I do think that there's an implicit criticism that he has been making of Democrats and Hillary Clinton's campaign for not being present and going to places like Michigan and Wisconsin as much as they could have to maintain some of those lunch pail Democrats that had been such a key pillar of the Democratic Party for decades. Yeah.
Domenico Montanaro, lead politics editor at NPR. Domenico, thank you.
Thank you, as always.
What if everyone, rich or poor, got a basic income from the government? It's an old idea, actually. We're learning Thomas More floated it in Utopia hundreds of years ago. Thomas Paine proposed it during the American Revolution. Now, Finland has embarked on a two-year experiment to see whether providing a guaranteed income to 2,000 unemployed people there will free them to look for work without fear of losing benefits, or turn everyone into couch potatoes who stop looking for work because they're supported by the government. Let's find out more from Olli Kangas, a researcher at Kela, the Finnish government agency for social welfare programs. He joins us by Skype from Helsinki. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Well, first to start with what many people may be thinking, because Finland already has what many Americans would consider a very expansive benefit system. We're reading that a family of four that loses a job can get up to 75% of their previous wages through public assistance. Here in the U.S., it's about 25%. So why isn't that good enough, the benefits program that you already have?
Perhaps it's good enough, and the problem is that sometimes it's too good enough. In that sense that we have social security benefits that are paid on top of each other. If a person gets unemployment benefit, and then the person gets usually housing benefit, and sometimes also social assistance that compensates some extra costs.
So you're saying you have the basic question that many people have about social assistance. In Finland, they get so much help, which is wonderful, but it discourages them from getting work because any work they get, they will lose those benefits.
So that the situation may be that if the employer offers a short-term job, what will happen when the job is terminated? Will I again qualify for the benefit?
Yeah.
And then we have that bureaucratic trap and we have that monetary incentive trap. And then very often the person is saying that no, I will stay on dole. And what the government is now hoping that the basic income is kind of trampoline. And whatever happens with the person can have that money, 560 euros in this experiment. The government is hoping this increases employment and labor supply.
And when you're talking about this basic income, you're talking about covering the basics, that, you know, the things that people need to survive so that they know that they'll have enough money to, you know, put a roof over their head or whatever. But they can take this chance. And, you know, we're understanding that this is coinciding with a time when this is how work works. You may only be able to have a job for 2 or 3 months. This is part of the global economy. Explain that. Explain what's happened into some towns that we're seeing featured, like one in the New York Times, Oulu, where people used to fish salmon and send it up to Russia and it was steady income. But then, you know, technology companies came in and it's not so steady.
It's a response and answer to those changes that are taking place. Try to create possibilities for people to take risks and to start their own enterprises, small-scale enterprises, start freelancer jobs, etc. This is one possibility to create a new society so that the basic income would help people more and more. Perhaps we'll have low-paid jobs and many jobs and not the permanent jobs as they used to have.
Well, I mentioned Oulu in Finland. The New York Times profiles this town. And, you know, again, they used to fish and ship tar, I guess, to Russia. But then Nokia came in, and suddenly everybody was a communications worker. But then Nokia left, and so people were out of work, and people wanted to start small technology companies. But they were afraid to take that risk to lose their benefits. Now the thinking, the hope is that with a basic income, they can feel free to start businesses and then produce jobs. But what if the opposite happens? I mean, what if you discover that people say, you know what, I got a basic income, my parents had a basic income for our whole lives, and people turn into, you know, as I said, couch potatoes?
We don't know actually what will happen. We have very strong arguments that if people get money for free, in that case, they are lying in their hammocks and doing nothing, going to the nearest pub and drinking beer. On the other hand, we have persons who are saying that this is one possibility, but there are many other possibilities, for example, in that way that people are taking risks and starting their own enterprises. And the problem in the present system that we have here in Finland is that we have pretty good social security for employees, but the self-employed, they have some problems. In that way that if they start their own enterprise, then they will immediately lose the unemployment benefit, so that it's either on-off. In this experiment, we are trying to see if it's possible true basic income give wind on the wings of those people who will take risks, yeah, and to see if they can fly. So that we are hoping very much that in the beginning of 2018, we can start a second experiment, and 2019, the third one, and to expand the scope of those experiments so that they're covering not only unemployed persons.
Well, we know it's being considered in other ways, in other places. Oakland, California, there's an incubator, a private company that's considering it for its employees. There's different people who are looking at this idea of basic income, which, you know, sounds at the outset like, you know, a welfare system. But the hope is that it jumpstarts capitalism, that it gets people creating and working and generating dollars. We will keep an eye on it to see how it's going there. Ali Kangas, a researcher at Kela, the Finnish government agency for social welfare program, as they kick off one with 2,000 unemployed people across Finland receiving a basic income from the government in the hopes it will free them from welfare benefits so that they can go and take part-time work or create jobs. We'll see how that goes. Ali, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Cowboys used to be America's biggest box office stars. Film buffs tend to agree the heyday for Western film ended in the 1960s. But there's one spot in the southern Arizona desert where Westerns are still king. Stina Sieg from Here and Now contributor KJZZ paid a visit.
Even if you've never been to Old Tucson Studios, just west of Tucson, if you recognize this voice, you probably kind of have.
I'm looking at a tin star with a drunk pinned on it.
That, of course, is John Wayne, trying to scare some sobriety into a sheriff played by Dean Martin in Rio Bravo. It's one of the hundreds of movies and TV shows that's been filmed at Old Tucson Studios, including McClintock, Tombstone, and Little House on the Prairie. And yeah, those big hits were decades ago, but that doesn't seem to matter to the delighted audience at one of Old Tucson's many live stunt shows.
Well, that means every man for himself.
Stuntmen in full cowboy regalia are diving off buildings, running from flames, and dramatically dying.
When we're putting on a really great show, that's the person's expectation of what they would want to see cool cowboys do times 10.
Cass Anaya says he and his stunt buddies are celebrating cowboy culture by exaggerating it. That's how he sees Western movies, too. Westerns don't show us how the Wild West really was, he says. But he has no problem with romanticizing that time and place.
It's a part of legitimate, awesome storytelling and decidedly extremely American. When we talk to especially Germans and Japanese, it's so huge.
But these days, Old Tucson's crowds are not as huge as they used to be. On this Saturday, only a handful of people are on the miniature train that winds through the park. This would have been unthinkable just a few decades ago, when Old Tucson was the second most popular tourist attraction in Arizona, falling only behind the Grand Canyon. Its wide, dusty streets and ramshackle buildings were originally constructed for the 1940 flick Arizona, but Old Tucson really sprang to life in 1960, when a land developer opened it as a combination theme park and working studio lot. It was a winning recipe for years.
And then in 1995, there was a devastating fire that took about 40% of the property down.
Park spokesperson Mary Davis says Old Tucson has been forced to remake itself at a time when Westerns just are not pulling their weight like they used to.
Well, that's our biggest problem, is that Western genre as a whole has fallen off.
And Park historian P.J. Lawton worries that could mean we're losing touch with history, too.
If we lose that, then it leaves you kind of drifting, not knowing who you are or where you came from.
But maybe Lawton shouldn't fear.
You know, I walk around and I think about what it would really be like, not as a set, but what these people really went through, that, you know, really lived this life.
That's Jan Tilley, a baby boomer here with her 98-year-old mother. She seems charmed by the place, just like 14-year-old Salma Al-Dulaimi, here with her whole family, all originally from Iraq.
It shows us the old culture and how they lived, and it's really cool.
Another park historian, Teresa Nielsen, loves to hear that curiosity from kids. Brandishing a big smile and an even larger pistol, she tells me about her favorite visitor of the day.
Couldn't have been only 4 years old, and he walked in and he saw that standee in there of John Wayne. He's like, look, it's John Wayne, and he was so excited.
And Nielsen was excited, too, because she hopes that one day that little kid will teach his own little kid to love the cowboy spirit. And just maybe, he won't go riding off into the sunset. For Here and Now, I'm Stina Sieg.
The rain and snow continue in parts of California, and as those storms have moved east, they're also dumping precipitation in Colorado, creating conditions that some forecasters say could make this the most dangerous avalanche season in Colorado in a generation. Joining us now on Skype from Boulder is Scott Tepfer, who's a forecaster for the Colorado Avalanche Information Center. Scott, how many avalanches have there already been in the past few days?
Well, we've had at least a dozen that have gotten to valley floors. It's almost impossible to see anything above treeline or even near treeline right now, given the ongoing weather that we're getting here in Colorado.
Well, what are the conditions? What are the weather conditions that are leading to this increased risk of avalanche?
Well, recently, say the last week or so, we've just had this continuous stream of moisture pushing through Colorado, and that's been coming in as snowfall, even rain down at the lower elevations. And then we've just had some really strong winds as well, and that really moves some snow around. And oftentimes that snow moves into avalanche starting zones and makes things even more touchy.
And we're seeing warnings that this could be the most dangerous threat of avalanches in a generation. Is that your sense?
Well, I wouldn't say a generation, but it has certainly been an eye-opening couple of days in here. We've seen some really large natural avalanches, and we've hit an extreme avalanche danger over near Crested Butte. And it's been a long time since I've seen an extreme danger in Colorado.
And you're joining us from an operations center where you've been communicating via radio with people. What kind of things are you dealing with right now as you look at this threat of avalanches?
Well, one of the primary things that we're trying to keep a heads up on is just keeping our highway corridors open. So highway crews are just totally maxed out, just keeping what roads we have open. But of course, our main job is forecasting for backcountry avalanche conditions for recreationists. And that has been challenging as well.
Well, and when we look at the map that you've got, the avalanche forecast map on the web, a lot of areas in red, meaning they're on high alert for avalanches, and one in black that's an extreme warning. So what can you do when you do have an area that's in red or in black? What can be done to keep people safe?
Well, the main thing that we can do to keep people safe is keep our website updated. And when it's at red or even black, you just don't want to go out into avalanche terrain. And that's what we recommend. Do not go into avalanche terrain, because avalanches are from very likely to certain right now. And some of these could be really quite large. And it might be the kind of avalanche that if you're out there and you get caught and buried in an avalanche, we may not find you till spring when you melt out.
So what's your forecast for the next few days and even the next few months? What are you expecting this season to be like?
Well, I don't think we're out of the woods yet. There's snow going on right now. There's another little pulse that comes in later this afternoon. We might get a little bit of a lull overnight. And then we've got another storm that's dropping down the West Coast, and that could bring significant snowfall once again to our southern mountains of Colorado. And that may even by the end of the weekend turn into a very large storm for the eastern side of the Colorado Rockies. So it's almost like we're going to be jumping out of the frying pan and into the fire by the looks of things right now.
That's Scott Tepfer, who's a forecaster for the Colorado Avalanche Information Center. Scott, thanks so much and best of luck.
Hey, Jeremy, thanks a million. Appreciate your time.
Today on Capitol Hill, three of President-elect Donald Trump's cabinet choices are facing confirmation hearings. Jeff Sessions for Attorney General, Elaine Chao for Transportation Secretary, and Rex Tillerson, the former ExxonMobil chief, for Secretary of State. He has faced hours of questioning, largely on his relationship with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Tillerson has had extensive business dealings in Russia. He even received a friendship award from Putin. But he seemed to strike a harder tone today, saying the U.S. needed to take a stand against Russia and blaming the current administration for acting weak when, for instance, Russia annexed Crimea. He was also questioned on climate change, which got a little tense when Virginia Democrat Tim Kaine, the senator and former vice presidential candidate, brought up reports claiming that ExxonMobil funded climate change denial and then sought to cover it up. Here's Kaine first.
I'm not asking you on behalf of ExxonMobil. You've resigned from ExxonMobil. I'm asking you whether those allegations about ExxonMobil's knowledge of climate science and decision to fund and promote a view contrary to its awareness of the science, whether those allegations are true or false.
The question would be have to be put to ExxonMobil.
And let me ask you, do you lack the knowledge to answer my question, or are you refusing to answer my question?
A little of both.
He's honest there. Today was also day two of hearings for Trump's nominee for Attorney General, Alabama Republican Senator Jeff Sessions. He testified yesterday. Today, the Senate Judiciary Committee is hearing testimony from others about Sessions, including New Jersey Democratic Senator Cory Booker. Booker, the first sitting senator to testify against a fellow senator's nomination for a cabinet position.
Senator Sessions has not demonstrated a commitment to a central requisite of the job, to aggressively pursue the congressional mandate of civil rights, equal rights, and justice for all of our citizens. In fact, at numerous times in his career, he has demonstrated a hostility towards these convictions and has worked to frustrate attempts to advance these ideals. If confirmed, Senator Sessions will be required to pursue justice for women, but his record indicates that he won't. He will be expected to defend the equal rights of gay and lesbian and transgender Americans, but his record indicates that he won't. He will be expected to defend voting rights, but his record indicates that he won't.
Well, others, including Larry Thompson, a former deputy attorney general in the George W. Bush administration, testified to Sessions' willingness and ability to enforce the law fairly. And while things got tense for both Tillerson and Sessions, the confirmation of Elaine Chao to lead the Transportation Department appears to be going smoothly. Chao is a veteran of three Republican administrations and wife of Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. We'll be watching as all the hearings continue. Meanwhile, what would you do if you heard your pension fund was failing? Well, if you're Mark Green, a UPS driver in Kingston, New York, you'd collect money from coworkers and launch an investigation. Now, like 34,000 other truckers, Mark is covered by the New York State Teamsters Conference Pension and Retirement Fund, which has applied to the Treasury Department for permission to cut back benefits because less than half of its obligations to members are funded. Yes, the fund got hit by the market collapse of 2008, and there are fewer union truckers in the country, so fewer dues. But Mark wondered what else is going on. Mark Green joins us now. And Mark, we know when you learned your pension plan was facing cuts of at least 20%, you started a nonprofit, the Teamsters Alliance for Pension Protection, hired a lawyer, Edward Siddell. So what made you think this extra investigation was needed?
Well, we all asked, how did we go from one of the best pension funds in the United States only a few years ago to now one of the worst? You know, many of us workers have had our wages forfeited.
And when you say forfeited, you've been docked.
Correct. Deferred. Yeah. Wage deferrals, thousands of dollars per year. And we've also had to postpone our retirements. And the promise was that by taking these cuts, the pension fund would be 84% funded within 10 years. That was the promise. So here we are, 6, 7 years later, and we're 45% funded. And that is where basically 2016 turned into an investigation into why this happened.
Well, you hired a former Securities and Exchange Enforcement lawyer from a company called Benchmark Financial Services. What did he find?
Well, there's a long list. This was a preliminary investigation. Some key findings, Robin, would be subpar investment performance. Basically, we're underperforming global equities right now. And one thing he also noted was that from 2005 till present, the trustees adopted a sophisticated, and I'm going to quote, sophisticated, bold, private placement investment strategy. And as many people know, alternative investments have high fees and are very risky.
These are like hedge funds, private equity deals?
Yeah, in infrastructure, real estate, and the list goes on. And our fund, as he noted, Mr. Saddell noted, has approximately $767 million allocated or committed to alternative investments. And this is of a $1.2 billion fund. So that's a pretty large allocation for a fund of that size.
Now, we should say the New York Teamsters Union Pension Fund disputes your conclusions that, you know, these were not opaque, they were high-cost investments. They say this is grossly inaccurate. You say what?
Well, the Department of Labor has all of their information. Mr. Saddell reviewed over 2,000 pages of printed documents, and so they can't dispute these findings because the DOL has them.
Department of Labor.
Correct.
Well, what do you want to have happen now? Would you like to replace the trustees, the Board of Trustees?
Yes. There's a petition with probably 1,000 signatures so far, and we need professionals in there that can handle these funds.
And we should say, by the way, that this is a multi-employer plan. So it's a group of workers, but there's a whole different number of employers for those different workers. And again, according to the New York Times reporting, these are at far greater risk of failure than a single employer plan. But what do you say to people on your board of trustees who might say, look, we were trying to make our money go as far as possible? A lot of people bought into these, you know, alternative investments, these private equity deals and hedge funds. They were trying to get the most money for you.
Yeah, you know, that may have been the original goal, but it didn't protect us from downside risk because, as the numbers really bring out in their own newsletters, the fund's own newsletters, we have been underperforming.
Well, you know, Mark, there's a hard, fast math here. If the money's not there, all the research that you've done, all the investigation that you've done, doesn't change that fact that the money's not there. What happens to the fund's request to cut back your benefits if the money's not there?
Yes. We're working on a solution. Aside from this forensic study, there's a lot going on behind the scenes with our nonprofit. We've become a lobby group, and we're trying to get some changes to legislation aside from the MIPRA law, Multi-Employer Pension Reform Act, that's on the books right now. We're trying to get different legislation, which would involve low-interest loans. That's the only way we're going to survive this. We need low-interest loans, which are secured with the good faith of some of the companies in the plan.
In other words, getting loans to cover the shortfall.
Correct.
Mark Green, how do you, I mean, you're a, you know, we love our UPS drivers. there's a terrific song about the men in the brown shorts, but and women in the brown shorts. But you are a UPS driver. Do you ever stop and think, did I get in over my head? Or maybe the opposite, I can't believe I did this.
Well, like I said, it wasn't just me. Mm-hmm. It was a group of 6 to 12 hardworking coworkers here, some retirees. And there's a lot of people doing the lifting. No, we don't feel like we've gotten in over our head, and we feel like we've just begun this battle, actually. This isn't just about New York State or the Teamsters in New York State. This is about protecting retirement security for everybody.
Well, you may have never felt you were in over your head, or your heads, the group there, but other people did. What was your response when people said to you, you know, you're the worker, you don't have a right to do this?
Well, what I told them was that it's our money. You know, tremendous amounts of contributions on our behalf has gone into these funds. They're deferred wages. You know, a lot of people have 401ks, but we normally, in these multi-employer plans, don't have 401ks. This is our retirement that we're planning on. So what gives me the right? It's my money.
Yeah. So. That's Mark Green, a UPS driver in Kingston, New York, a member of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, but also the founder with coworkers of a nonprofit to do a forensic study on his own failing pension plan. Mark, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin, for having me.
Donald Trump held his first press conference today since being elected president. In fact, it was the first time he has taken questions in that format since July, and a lot has happened since then. Questions about conflicts of interest, news of Russia's alleged involvement in the U.S. election from American intelligence agencies, and now, most recently, the appendix to an intelligence report based on unsubstantiated claims that went public yesterday. The two-page appendix was based on a 35-page document with explosive but completely unverified allegations of a deeper connection between Trump and Russia, as well as some more salacious details. BuzzFeed published the document in full, as other news organizations, including NPR, decided not to. Here's Trump's response today.
I think it's a disgrace that information that was false and fake and never happened got released to the public. As far as BuzzFeed, which is a failing pile of garbage, writing it, I think they're going to suffer the consequences. They already are.
Joining us now is NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik, who was at the press conference in New York today. Hi, David.
Hey, Jeremy.
And was BuzzFeed wrong to publish these documents?
Well, you've seen an astonishing journalistic debate break out all day, much of it unifying some unexpected figures on the right and on the significant left, critics of Trump and defenders of him alike, who say, gosh, this includes such salacious material and it is completely admittedly unverified. The allegations being that somehow this salacious material would be used by the Russians to blackmail Donald Trump into somehow being influenced or even an asset for the Russian government, for Vladimir Putin, and also that some of his people would be having connections with the Russians that would seemingly possibly fall afoul of federal law. BuzzFeed says, hey, you know, we are presenting this because the public deserves to know what it is that the president, Barack Obama, and what the president-elect Donald Trump were briefed on, what they were informed about, what the intelligence agencies took seriously enough, allegedly from a former British military official acting as a sort of political opposition investigator against Trump, came up with, but somebody who had some credibility, and that they needed to share this with the public. A lot of journalists are saying, look, this is unverified stuff. We have the right to publish, as Bill Keller, the former executive editor of the New York Times, wrote to me this morning. He said, you know, we also have the right not to publish things, that simply the act of publishing confers a degree of credibility. You're seeing a back and forth pull on this.
Well, there was an interesting exchange this morning between Kellyanne Conway, the soon to be counselor to the president, on CBS this morning with Nora O'Donnell. And here they are.
We're talking about that this morning because in addition, you have some news sources going over, I think, really violating basic journalistic standards.
Agreed.
And thank you. Thank you for agreeing. Mm-hmm. And thanks to CBS for agreeing, frankly.
Thanks to CBS for agreeing, she said, meaning that they decided not to publish or, in fact, talk about some of the details. And it sounds like many other mainstream news organizations have decided to do the same.
That's right. And I think there's some tough choices here. NPR's decided not to characterize what it is that's at play here. Donald Trump seemingly gave a little indication of what it might involve. His behavior we're characterizing as allegedly salacious, although unverified. He said, well, I'm a germaphobe, folks. So how much credibility do you really put in this? You know, it's tawdry stuff. But that's the stuff that has been alleged in this way and presented in this dossier. I think a lot of news organizations say we don't want to do this. This was stuff that was circulated to journalists in the months leading up to the election. David Corn, you know, definitely a left of center critic of Donald Trump
at
from
Mother Jones. Right.
But nonetheless, he had this material and characterized the nature of some of the investigations and allegations and at the same time held back saying, we can't verify this, so I'm not going to put these allegations out there. So a lot of folks, whether or not they are supposedly nonpartisan or opposed to Donald Trump, have had real reservations about presenting this to the public. And that's the role, in a sense, of how the media gets its name. It's mediating information saying this needs to be shared to the public. I talked to somebody like Dick Toeffel, who's the head of the investigative group ProPublica today, and he says, look, that seems to me to be kind of assuming that the public can't be trusted to understand when you present something in a contextualized way, as BuzzFeed attempted to, that some of this information is raw and is not proven. You know, he said, I think in this day and age, the public needs to have the information about what it is the president and the president-elect are being briefed on. These are very different ways of thinking about this kind of information.
David, just a few seconds left, but let's listen to a moment from today's press conference with Jim Acosta of CNN.
Mr. President-elect, since you are attacking our news organization, can you give us a chance?
Your organization
is terrible. You are attacking our news organization. Can you give us a chance to ask a question, sir?
Go ahead.
Sir, can you state, Mr. President-elect, can you state categorically,
she's asking a question.
Mr. President-elect, can you give us a question?
Don't be rude.
You're attacking us. Can you give us a question?
Don't be rude.
Can you give us a question?
I'm not going to give you a question.
Can you state categorically?
David, sounds like Trump's going to have a good relationship with the media.
You can really feel the love right there. Yeah. You know, CNN also published about the thing, did not publish the dossier itself. Trump makes no distinction.
That's NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. David, thank you so much.
You bet.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.